everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bias Check-In.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this Monday episode.
We are almost back to normal.
We are now both in Chicago and we'll be recording together soon.
But until then, Claudia, what are we checking in with?
I think you just jinxed us. But we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Joining us today on the BCI microphones is Dr. Gordon Curfee, SIOP 2021 Trend Champion for Team Effectiveness Across Virtual and Distributed Environments. In other words, what everyone has either loved or endured over the past 18 months, some teams long before the pandemic happened, virtual teams and geographically dispersed teams. Dr. Curfee received this title after the publication of his latest book, Ignition, A Guide to Building High-Performing Teams, in collaboration with Dr. Diane Nielsen and Dr. Robert Hogan. Dr. Curfee's career so far has covered and spanned from the United States Air Force, of which he is also an alum, to private consulting practice at Curfee Leader Solutions, focusing on leadership for individuals and teams. Dr. Curfee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you again for being with us today. Starting from the beginning, in general, how can we tell when a team is successful or not? What makes a team stand out for you or stand the test of time?
Well, if you look at some of the research, and I really like the work that Scott Tannenbaum and Edward Salas have done around teams, you know, they define high-performing teams as one that has sustained superior performance. So they achieve consistent results. Those results are better than other teams. They adapt to changing situations. So, you know, when stuff happens, they move quickly. They're pretty nimble. And third, they get better over time. You know, we know, for example, sporting teams, if we think about the NFL, which is, you know, the regular season just kicked off, you know, where they were at with the preseason versus where those teams are going to be at by the time the playoffs happen, they're going to be playing much better football. And it's true with virtual teams also.
Yes, as Chicago-based, at the time of recording, the Bears have not exactly started this season on the strongest foot or the strongest paw. So that metaphor hits a little close to home recording on Monday.
I think the Bears will do better than the Minnesota Vikings, which is where I'm from. So it's going to be a long season in Minnesota.
I just want to remind everyone that I'm a Steelers fan, not a Bears fan. But moving on, Claudia.
From what you've seen over the course of this year and since you became the trend champion for virtual teams, how would you grade teams during the pandemic? What are you observing since we started going remote? Or maybe if there's any changes now that businesses are returning to quote-unquote normal and hybrid formats?
Yeah, well, the research before the pandemic struck showed that one out of every five teams were high performing. So, you know, 80% of teams needed help. And that was before the pandemic. This is when everybody was more or less co-located. I mean, clearly there were a number of virtual teams back, you know, 2 years ago, but I think that the trend has gotten exacerbated over time. Now, I would guess the rate of high performance among virtual teams is 10% or less. I think generally speaking, if you didn't know how to build a team before the pandemic struck, you certainly don't know how to build a team now. And with everybody working remotely, it's gotten very difficult to get people working effectively together towards common ends. I think moving back to some sort of a hybrid model will be really helpful for teams.
Hybrid, our new favorite word. Dr. Curfee, can you go into what the rocket model is?
So when we think about building high-performing teams, we think about three things. One is teams need some sort of a roadmap so they understand how to become high-performing. And there are different roadmaps out there, like there's Lencioni's five dysfunctions of a team, there's Wiley's five behaviors of a cohesive team, there's the Hackman model, there's the Tuchman, forming, storming, norming, and performing model, there's the Drexler-Sibbett model. We have a model called the Rocket model, which is designed to provide practitioners primarily a roadmap for building high-performing teams. So the Rocket model consists of 8 components. Those 8 components are all supported by different meta-analyses, so they're well supported by research. But we've built this model to make it very easy for practitioners to use so they understand, here are the things I have to attend to in order to build a high-performing team. But a roadmap is only the first part of this. So one is, let's make sure we're all on the same page. We're all singing from the same sheet of music when it comes to building a high-performing team. Everybody understands, here's the things we have to attend to. The second thing we have to do is provide teams with feedback. So just because we understand what the model is, doesn't necessarily tell us where do we fall on the model. What of those 8 components are we doing well? Which ones are we not doing so well? How does our team performance stack up against other teams on the model? So we're, you know, as IO psychologists, we're a big believer in data. So we think we have an instrument called the Team Assessment Survey, which is an online survey. It's about a 45-item survey, which is designed to provide teams with benchmarking feedback against the 8 Rocket model components. But what we know from the 360 research and coaching research that has been done is just because you give a person or a team feedback does not necessarily mean they're going to get any better. You know, we can provide teams with feedback and say, here's what you're doing well and here's what you're not doing so well. It's kind of like, okay, I'm not doing this well. Now what? And what we've done is I've written a book with Diane Nilsen and Bob Hogan from Hogan Assessment Systems fame, which many people know, called Ignition, A Guide for Building High-Performing Teams. And what that book does is have 15 chapters that are designed to address different team dilemmas, like how do I launch a brand new team? How do I manage a matrix team? How do I manage a virtual team? Along with 40 different team improvement activities. And these team improvement activities are specific activities you do with the team. It could be 1 to 2 hours long, designed to address a specific team problem, like how do I make sure we run efficient and effective meetings? How do we make sure the team uses good decision-making processes? How do we make sure the team has clear goals? And there are 40 of those activities. And so one of the things we try to do is work with teams to provide them a roadmap so we understand, okay, here's what high performance looks like on a team. Here's the things you have to attend to. Here's what the data tell us about how well you're doing against the model. And here's the activities we'll use to help you get from good to great or help you get launched or to fix you if you're broken. So that's the process we use.
Some of the things you have mentioned should and probably do feel very familiar to our listeners. I think everyone has been on a less than optimal team at one point or another in their career or in their academic time. Everyone has been through ineffective meetings or conversations that didn't quite get to a conclusion before. So everyone could benefit from having a more efficient and more successful team. On this note, I'm curious to see, not asking you to name and shame, of course, but can you mention maybe any excellence examples that you've encountered in your consulting work from teams that have been very, very successful that grew very well? Or maybe any behavioral red flags that you have seen or that you expect to see in teams when they have room to grow?
Well, there's a number of examples. We've actually written up a number of case studies where teams have gotten from being really broken to becoming high performing. For example, last week I was working with a talent acquisition team, global talent acquisition team, 400 people in this organization. So it's a big company. They're brand new leader. And one of the things I recommend for onboarding is, and it's one of the things that's very rarely done with onboarding programs, is have the team that you're inheriting take our team assessment survey. So here's the team I'm taking over. How well is this team performing? Is this already a high-performing team? Is this kind of an okay performing team? Or is this really a pretty dysfunctional team? And this was a brand new leader. They'd only been in place for a couple of months. We had done the team assessment survey, and it was a pretty broken team that he was inheriting. And what we ended up doing last week was sharing that feedback with the team. They all admitted that, yep, we're pretty broken. And so we spent a bit of time going through the feedback, getting all the grievances out on the table, getting all the issues identified, and then identifying three key issues that need to get resolved that will help this broader organization function a lot better. I was on the phone with the team leader today, actually, because I'm coming back in a month. And there's a number of assignments that we're having the team complete before we get together. And then we're going to have them report back on these three big issues that they're grappling with and having to do a bunch of work on and come up with their best recommendations about how to solve these problems, as well as work on their meetings, work on their decision-making, and clarify roles and responsibilities for people on the team. What we've done is what I'm going to call a mixture of what I call task work and teamwork. Teams have got to get certain things done in order to be effective. And these three big problems, these big three big issues they have to grapple with are things they have to do and things they have to deliver. That's really more task work. But when we look at how they run their meetings and what they can do to improve their decision-making processes and what they can do to clarify roles and responsibilities or who is supposed to be involved in what decisions or who gets to make what decisions, that's more teamwork. And good team meetings, good team offsites have this mix of both, I'm calling it task work and teamwork. It's not all fun and games. I mean, many times when I see folks do quote unquote team building, it's really, entertainment. You know, can you come in for an hour and do some team building for me? Well, I'll say, nope, not me. I'm the last, if you want to have some real tough conversations about what's going on with the team and help the team get from point A to point B in terms of performance, I'm all in. If you want to be entertained, hire some other consultant.
Pre-pandemic company picnics were great, fun, lovely to see everyone's kids. Not necessarily in line with the objectives for the quarters every time. So that makes a lot of sense. I think it's very easy, very common to confuse culture building or climate events, pizza parties with an actual team assessment and team building activity.
Some of these are fine, but the point is you want to make sure these are in the background versus the foreground. If you've got an 8-hour day, you might have an hour that's spent on, or an hour and a half spent on doing something like that. And the other 6.5 hours are spent on grappling with real team issues. So for example, I've got to do an offsite in Austria in January. And we're going to do, this is for the top team of about a $10 billion company. And we're going to do about an hour and a half team building event, but then it's going to roll right into our rocket model and the team assessment survey feedback they're going to get. So it'll just be a setup for having these conversations for the data we've collected about this particular team. Nothing worse than doing an offsite, in an Austrian ski resort in January.
Terrible idea. I don't know how you can do that.
As someone originally from the Alps, I will be thinking of you with lots of empathy and sending thoughts and prayers.
You've got great skiing in Chicago, don't you?
This is why people don't like consultants.
Yeah, it's kind of cool because I end up doing, I've worked with about 200 top teams. And so, you get to go to some pretty cool places when you work with these teams.
I mean, it's a good balance. You may have to facilitate some really hard conversations, as you were saying, not every team building is sitting in a circle, singing songs around the fire. But if we can have some song singing or some alpine skiing, why should we deny ourselves that after some hard work?
Yeah. I think the issue is making sure you do more of the having the hard talk conversations than the fun team building stuff, but doing some of the fun stuff is important.
Yeah, I like this baseline of, yes, we're here to work and it's going to be hard, but at the same time, we're going to have a little bit of fun, you're going to relax, and this is going to feel like a safe space for everyone involved.
Our line is that you build teams by having them do real work. And so, having some of these activities can help tee up the real work phase. But when you just do nothing but ropes courses and scavenger hunts, and somehow think that that's going to relate to the struggles teams are going with or the issues that they really have to resolve. It's a pretty big stretch, I think, in most cases.
Going back a little bit more strictly, I appreciate the conversation on teams in general, because no man is an island. We will always have to collaborate with someone at some point towards a common goal. But taking it back to the theme of virtual teams specifically, how do you find that balance between, say, the fun or more lighthearted parts of team building and having that constructive criticism and those hard conversations when you're lacking so much of communication or even background or where the team members are coming from in every sense possible?
I think teams is really much more difficult to do these sorts of activities with virtual teams versus in person. And so for me, I've been lucky in that the travel has opened up in the last 6 or 8 weeks. I've basically been on the road every week, working with the Intact team. For example, about 3 months ago, maybe 4 months ago, I was doing a series of offsites for one of the largest mining companies in Mexico. Wonderful people, really, really, really good people, really wanting to do good work. And we did a bunch of good work there, but it was a lot harder to do virtually versus if we would have been able to get together for a couple of days. It took us, a month to get through what we could have done in probably 2 days had we been able to get together in person. You can just read the room. You can just see what's going on, and you cannot do that virtually.
Absolutely. And also interacting with people and seeing if they're actually there in the moment or in that headspace. Another question we have, or this one is mostly from our audience. We asked them to send us questions. And the number one question was how to be a better team member.
Well, it's kind of interesting. One of the things we look for, because I've got a strong individual differences background. So I've done a lot, like 1500 VP and above assessments. We're involving, mental ability tests, personality tests, business simulations, 360s, team surveys, structured interviews, all that sort of stuff. One of the things that I think Tannenbaum and Salas point out, and I think they're absolutely right about this, is collective orientation. There are a lot of people who really like working on teams. If you look at the Hogan Motives, Values, and Preferences inventory, would be like a high affiliation score. Or if you see people on the Hogan personality inventory with high sociability, high interpersonal sensitivity scores, these are people who really like being in groups and being in teams and working collectively. On the other hand, you got people with really low scores in those dimensions. They're more like cats. They really don't want to work on a team. And actually the virtual stuff's worked out great for them. It's like, I don't need to see you people. I'm going to turn my damn screen off and we're going to have a conversation. Fine. I'm going to be doing something else. How to be a good team member. One is, do you really want to work on a team or not? Because it's really hard to force that issue. Some people, again, are like working on teams. Some people don't. I think the other thing to look at with teams in terms of being a good team member has to do with trust. I think most models, most consultants get trust all screwed up on teams. All right. They really have some misguided notions on trust on teams. And what I mean by that is if you read like Patrick Lencioni's book, he says, the way you build trust on a team is you have everybody take the MBTI and then they share the results and then everybody trusts each other. BS. That doesn't happen that way. Trust is a mediating variable. It's not an input variable. It's something that develops over time. And so there's three things that you need to build trust on a team. One is there's this thing called the ability component, which means that, Susie, you've got all the right skills needed to do your part. Claudia, I feel you've got all the right skills to do your part. Gordy's got all the right skills to do his part. Everybody on the team has got the level of experience and competence needed to carry out their assigned tasks. Because if I feel like you don't know what you're doing, guess what? I'm not going to trust you. So when it comes to being an ideal team member, first and foremost, be a subject matter expert at what you do, or at least, be competent at what you do. The second piece is to being an effective team member is demonstrate some benevolence. So benevolence is the second component of trust. And benevolence is all about, are you going to do the right thing for the team? Or are you going to pursue your own selfish interests? So if we've got people on a team, and I think there's two people there who've got their own agenda going on, and they're not going to do the right thing for the team. They're basically going to throw the team under the bus as soon as they get a chance, and they're going to bolt. That's not being a good team member. That doesn't foster a sense of trust on a team. And I think the third thing that's got to happen is this notion of integrity. And so when it comes to being a good team member, one is, you know, do you want to be on the team? But two, do you have the right sort of technical expertise necessary to pull off your assigned tasks? Are you going to do what's right for the team? And are you going to demonstrate a high level of integrity in terms of, again, safeguarding confidential information, following the rules, and following through with your commitments? That's how you be a good team member. I remember working with one chief product officer for about a $6 billion high-tech firm. And the chief product officer would never return a phone call or an email from anybody on the executive leadership team, even that of the CEO, just never did, because he thought he was smarter than everybody else. He just didn't think he had to account to everybody else. And so we were running an offsite for this team. This was about in November. We were running an offsite for the team in early January. And I gathered this information, and you know, this chief product officer was universally disliked. Nobody trusted the guy any farther than you could throw him. He was constantly disparaging people behind their backs, wouldn't return phone calls. And so I just went to the CEO. I said, look, we can handle this two ways. We can have our offsite and have him there, and there'll be a dead elephant in the room that nobody will talk about. Or you fire this guy before the end of the year. We have the offsite in January, and it's going to be a completely different conversation. And credit to the CEO, he fired the chief product officer. And so when we got together in January, it was a much richer, a much more productive conversation. The team still had issues to deal with beyond this individual. But, you know, I'm the first one to say as a trained assessor, you know, not everybody should be on a team.
As the saying goes, there's no I in team. Really, only have one more question for you. As you know, at the end of our episodes, we like to ask our guests to get on our imaginary soapbox. And so what advice do you have for our listeners? What's the one thing that if they were zoning out for the rest of the episode, you would like them to walk away with? By the way, if you are zoning out and you're feeling called out right now, rewind, re-listen, and then get back to this moment. But the one most important thing, and this can be related to teams, to leadership, or completely unrelated, as you wish.
I think the one thing I would like to share with folks, or I hope the one thing they take away from this podcast, is that leadership is a team sport. It's interesting when you look at most of the definitions of leadership, they say nothing about teams. Most leadership competency models say nothing about teams. Yet without teams, leaders are not going to get a whole lot accomplished. Teams are essentially echo chambers for a leader. If you have a leader who has built a high-performing team, she is going to get a lot accomplished. She's really going to do a lot. I mean, that team is going to be sort of a magnifying effect on her skills and abilities. On the other hand, if you have a leader who has not built a high-performing team and or is even built a dysfunctional team, they just are not going to get a lot done. And people are going to be disengaged and turnover is going to be really high. So I just find it really, really interesting that teams are the natural structures we use to get things done in organizations. Yet we give them short shrift. We don't even know how many teams are in many organizations. We know how many employees they have. We don't have to know how many teams they have. And we know that the research tells us that only 1 in 5 of those teams are high performing. And I guess, you know, and I think that fits with most people's personal experience. If you ask people, just think about the number of teams they've been on in the past and just say, okay, what percentage of those teams were high performing? My hunch is 10 or 20%. So everybody knows good teamwork when they know, when they see it. All organizations want effective teamwork, yet they do just about everything they can to make sure it doesn't happen. Not on purpose, but our talent management systems are over-indexed on the individual as opposed to teams.
Dr. Kerfee, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully listening to these episodes and looking into the resources you shared with us, our listeners can maybe evaluate their own teams a little bit, do a little bit of soul searching into how to be a better team member or team leader.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. Sorry, there was a boxer trying to give us his input.
Lots of food for thought as we move through the episodes and as we move into our own careers to think about our teams and the roles that we play in them.
To everyone that has been sending in questions, we appreciate you. We have one more guest left for Smart Workplace Awareness Month, so please keep sending in your questions.
If you're wondering, gee, where can I send those questions? You can do so through all of our social media, our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under Bias Check-In Podcast. You can also contact us through email at biascheckin@gmail.com. Or if you want to be on the microphones with us, you can also send us a voice note on anchor.fm. Thank you, everyone, and looking forward to your questions. Let's talk next week.
See you in the next one. Bye.